We are in Mishle, Perek Yud Beis, 12. I believe that's what we're up to. There are some who say that 11 and 12 are combined, but others say 12 and 13 are combined. So I gave you 12 through 14. So 12, Yud Beis. Let's read it together. Chamad Rasha Mitzod Ra'im. Okay, different ways of understanding this. We'll see in a second. Chamod Rasha Mitzod Ra'im. Ra'im is not Ra'im. It's not fellows, but it's, you know, evil people. Right, so what does that mean? Chamad Rasha, says the art scroll, a wicked person. Chamod, we know, or chamad, we know, is to covet, right? So here it says, a wicked person craves mitzod ra'im. Mitzod is an interesting word. Mitzod could come from the word latsud, to trap, meaning that an evil person seeks or covets the trappings, or the, here it says, the spoils of other evil people. Mitzod ra'im. You ever find some, you know, a person who's not so great praising someone else who's not so great? That's what we're talking about here. Someone who, you know, is out, you know, to fulfill their own desires, is jealous of someone who already fulfilled their desires, right? They're all sort of chasing after the same type of thing. So that's what it says here. Here in the Sefari, it translates, the wicked covet the catch of evil men. However, v'shoresh tzadikim yitain. The root of the righteous will provide for them. It's kind of interesting how to understand that pasuk, but that's what it says here. The shoresh of tzadikim, the root of the tzadik, will give to them. So what does that mean? If you look at the Mitzudas David, so Mitzudas David says, chamad harasha chomed lasheves b'mivtzar haraim. He understands it a little bit differently, although it's the same type of thing. The evil person, the wicked person, seeks or wishes, desires that he could sit, he could live in the same place as the other wicked people. Asher yizchazku sham la'asos chamas. Right? They, they go over, basically, you know, the way that they say it is, like, they, you know, he, the evil person goes over to the other evil person's house to figure out, you know, the tricks of the trade. Here in the art scroll footnote here, it says a little bit differently. Let me see for a second. He says, a wicked person frequents the fortress of evil people where they strengthen themselves to commit more violence. That's how they understand it. Not necessarily that they're planning together, but by coveting what the other person's done and by sort of connecting to them and sort of like, how did you do this? How did you do that? They build up their own, you know, their own desires, their own motivation to do it themselves. However, the tzaddikim, the Mitzudas David continues, aval ha-tzaddikim einam tzrichim la'ezer mibachutz. They don't need anybody's help from the outside. Kisho rasham yitain piryam. Their own roots are going to give their fruits. Right? They're shoresh. They're entrenched in the ground. Yitain piryam haraoi. Where does a righteous person get the motivation to be a righteous person? From the inside. They don't need anybody else to motivate them from the outside. This is very interesting because it doesn't only talk about the righteous versus the wicked. It talks about their sources of motivation. The source of motivation for the wicked person is he has to keep himself going by looking at other people, right? By looking at other people who have accomplished and who have fulfilled those desires, you have to look at those people to gin up your desires. But when it comes to a righteous person can learn from other people, but that's not what motivates them, right? Obviously, a righteous person, as we'll see soon, learns from other people, but that's not what motivates them, right? When they look at their righteousness and say, why should I be righteous? They say because they know internally it's about the right thing to do. Whereas a wicked person, they might be, you know, succumbing to their desires, but they're only going to chase after them if they see other people fulfilling them. That's what it sounds like for me, which is a very interesting concept. But it reminded me of a book I'm reading. This class is basically, you know, the outgrowth of, you know, all the books that I'm currently reading or recently read, and how I see them inside the Psukim of Shlomo HaMelech. So, what book am I reading now? It's actually a book that's a prequel to another book that I love. A book that I love that I've talked about before is the book called Grit by Angela Duckworth. So, a lot of her sort of mentality is based on another formidable, you know, best-selling book called, Mindset. I think it's called just Mindset, by Carol Dweck. Carol Dweck, CarolDweck. Carol Dweck. And she basically, the whole book is basically the compare and contrast of two different types of people. You have a type of person which she calls a fixed mindset, and a type of person who's called a growth mindset. A fixed mindset, and this is something I think naturally everyone sort of gravitates towards just because it's the lazier way. And as Daniel Kahneman says, our minds are geared by default to go the lazier way, right? The easy way out is our default. The path of least resistance, some will say. Even intellectually, there's such a thing. So says Carol Dweck, there are two types of people in the world. There are those types of people that think of the world, they think of other people, as being fixed. Now, she goes into sort of like the minutia of that and how you believe scientifically that everybody's, you know, born a certain way and they have certain qualities, they have certain skills. I don't think she even thinks that. But it's more about how you look at a person, right? When you see someone in front of you, do you look at them as if they're fixed in their way? Like, you know, for instance, you know, you look like a great basketball player, right? Do you see him as the culmination of a lot of hard work? Obviously, you know he's worked hard. But you also see him in the moment as a person who is good, or a person who is great, right? He has a certain skill level. He's great. You're not great. And that's it. He has his skills. I have my skills. And then you have a different mindset, which is a growth mindset, which is that he's still growing and he can get even better, and I'm still growing and I can get even better. And it's not that we're really competing or contrasting. It's not really like, you know, he's fixed in his skill set and I'm fixed in my skill set and we've got different skill sets. It's that we can both get better or worse, depending on how we act. And obviously when it comes to sort of physical things, you know, we're more... instinctively, we think more in terms of the fixed mindset, but we also think that there's room for growth. You know, a person is naturally talented in this thing, and I'm not. You know, that person can draw, and I can't draw. Right? How many people, you know, how many people here or the people that you know, if you can draw, you know, say to themselves, I don't know how to draw. You know, I only do stick figures. So the truth is, it's not true. If you go to classes, if you go to, you get training, so then you can become an artist. It's not something that people are born with. You know, Picasso wasn't born, you know, he might have surroundings, he might have hand-eye coordination that gives him a leg up in terms of where to work from. But there's a lot more training involved. And she talks about sort of counterintuitive examples are the ones that we think are internal. So for instance, intelligence, right? Many people think, and you know, probably the jury's still out to what the proportions are. Many people think that intelligence is fixed, that a person's brain capacity or a person's, the way that a person's brain is wired is absolutely fixed. You get that from birth. What you put in your brain is up to you, but your brain, you know, the synapses and the neurons, everything's fixed. The question is what you fill it with. So she says that the truth is it's like any other muscle. We've talked about this before, that you can grow your brain. Your brain can actually, flex and it can expand and it can strengthen. And this is something that Duckworth talks a lot about in terms of, you know, developing a person to think that they're not, you know, they don't have to settle for whatever they think their brain is. They can actually grow. And if you teach a child that he can be greater, so then he will become greater, right? If you teach a child that they can be a doctor, they'll become a doctor regardless of what their intellect is. And there are a lot of fascinating studies, including out of Israel. I think some of the main studies of this concept are from Israel. I think they told, there's a famous study, I can't remember what it was, but where they told a third grade teacher, you know, they have all these aptitude tests, you know, these aptitude tests. They don't give them anymore, I don't think. But they have the aptitude. What are the kids going to be when they grow up? Are they going to be a brilliant Albert Einstein, or are they going to be, you know, a truck driver or something? I don't know. So they gave the test to the kids, and they told the teacher the opposite. Right? This is a study that you probably can't get away with anymore. There's so many regulations with all these studies now. You don't want to make people feel bad or abuse people, whatever. They told the teacher the opposite. And the truth is, and as it turns out, the kids that they told them, the teachers, would be better, right, would be more successful, actually their grades improved by the end of the year, whereas the kids that they told weren't going to be so great, their grades did not improve by the end of the year. It really had to do more with how the teachers treated the kids more than the kids themselves. So that was sort of one of the hallmark experiments. But either way, why do I think about this? Because she, in Carol Dweck's book, she talks about the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset in terms of how do you judge yourself, right? When you look at yourself, what is the barometer with which you judge yourself? So I have the book upstairs, but I just got a random quote from a summary of the book where it says, behavior performance versus mastery. The people who believe that everything is fixed tend to be set on maintaining and validating their abilities, right? The ramifications of these two mindsets are very vast. So if you think you're a fixed person, what kind of thinking do you believe? So this is, you know, no one wakes up and says, I'm a fixed mindset person. What's the kind of thing that you would think if you're a fixed mindset person? The way that you judge yourself is based on validating what you think you're good at and sort of confirming what you think you're bad at, right? So you think you're good at, I don't know, whatever your job is. You think you're good at computers. So when you do something on the computer, you want other people to validate that what you did was good. And you don't, if someone, you know, God forbid, criticizes something you do on the computer, so you take it personally, because that's who you are. You're a computer person, right? And if you don't know something about computers, that means that's a shot at you, right? That's a fixed mindset, because that's who you're supposed to be. This is who I am, and if somebody's now attacking that persona, now I've got a problem, right? There's a problem with me. So that's what it tend to be. A fixed, someone who's fixed tend to be set on maintaining and validating their abilities, their intelligence, and their position in the world by performing in order that others may judge their intelligence, abilities, and status, right? So, for instance, I'm only going to do a project that I know I'm good at so that afterwards people can tell me that I did it well, right? Whereas if it's something difficult for me, something that I'm not good at, I don't want to do that because I know it's not going to be good and I don't want to be criticized about it. But if I would take on one of those projects that I'm supposed to be good at and someone criticizes me, so then that's a problem, as I said before. The people who believe that everything develops and grows, however, they think, set out to learn all they can and to improve all their skills so that their intelligence will increase and their abilities will develop and their eminence increase. The person who has a growth mindset is not afraid of doing something that they're not already good at. Right? They're willing to say, I can try to do that job. I can think about other strategies that I haven't used before, because I'm the type of person that wants to learn new things. They judge themselves not against other people, but against their previous selves to see how much they've improved. They seek to master any abilities and skills they may need to do They seek to master any abilities and skills they may need to do. They may need to do what they want in their lives. Okay, poorly constructed sentence. I didn't write it. Sometimes they try to learn or accomplish the most difficult things, not because they're easy, but because they're hard, right? So people with a growth mindset not only are comfortable taking on new tasks, but sometimes they seek them out because they want to learn, they want to grow. And it's obviously something that we can all work on. But that's the difference between the growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And that's also what's presumably, you know, at the heart of what the Mesudas David is saying, right? We say here, Chamad Rasha Mitzod Ra'im. The evil person looks at other people's accomplishments in order to motivate themselves to do what they want, right? To do their own, you know, their own evil behavior. However, that tzaddikim, Einam Tzrichim La'ezer Mibachutz. They don't need somebody else to dictate to them what exactly is right and wrong, or to dictate to them what they should be doing. Rather, kisho rasham yitain piryam. Who's going to decide what they're doing? They're going to decide it themselves. From their internal compass is going to tell them that they're supposed to be doing something. They're doing the right thing because they learned it from themselves. They don't base their activities. They don't base their motivations on what other people are telling them. Right. So it's reminding me of this growth versus fixed mindset. The righteous person is willing to grow by himself, whereas a fixed mindset person is debating, or not debating, but is judging themselves based on what other people will see, or what they see in other people. The next pasuk is connected to that, where it says, "Bepesha svasai mokeshra," with sinful speech. Sinful speech is a trap for the evil man. "Vayetse mitzara tzadik." However, the righteous person will escape from trouble. Now, what exactly this means, I can't tell you for sure. We're not going to focus too much on it. But in the art scroll, it translates it as, "In the sin of the lips lies a snare of evil, but a righteous person escapes travail." Basically means that when someone is doing something wrong, he'll speak poorly about other people so that he can sort of cover up his own stuff. Or when it comes to a righteous person, so why is it the righteous person is going to be better? Presumably because, I think, the way I'm understanding it, is because he's willing to be honest about it. At least that's sort of a drusha understanding of it. But let's see what Rashi says. Rashi doesn't say anything, so he's not going to help us there. But here in the article it says, the righteous people escapes travail. Through his pleasant words, a righteous person escapes distress. Okay. Unclear what that means, but the next pasuk might clarify it a little bit. Mipri pi ish yispatov. From the pre. The pre is like a fruit. Here it says from the fruit. There you go. Here a man gets his fill of good from the fruit of his speech. Meaning the way he speaks, the way he talks to other people, is going to be self-satisfying. Right, yispatov, he's going to be satisfied from what he says. What does that mean, he's going to be satisfied from what he says? So it says here, interestingly enough, that quoting a Gemara in Baba Basra, one who gives others charity, no, that's not what I wanted. A person should use his power of speech to help others and to influence them to do the right thing, and he can earn great reward for doing so. If others perform good deeds because of him, so then he will be rewarded himself. Meaning that the produce of a person's words is going to come back to himself. Meaning that's what it says, me pri pi ish yispato. From the words of his mouth, from the fruit of his mouth, he'll be satiated with good, right? So it doesn't mean that if you speak nicely, if you give someone a compliment, Hashem's going to reward you. But what it means is, when you speak to somebody nicely, or when you influence somebody to do good, so that whatever that person does good is going to reflect back on you. What I wanted to quote was the story they bring here in the Art Scroll, commentary. Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibowitz, the famed Rosh Yeshiva of Kamenetz, delivered an astounding original Torah drasha when he was only 14 years old. The 9-year-old Yechiel Michal Rabinowitz was so impressed that he resolved to become a great scholar himself, and he carried out his resolve, becoming the author of the highly regarded Afike Yam, right? Pes Sefer, famous book. Rabbi Baruch Ber was heard to say with humorous pride, "The Afike Yam is really mine." That's what he used to say, because he gave that drasha that influenced that one, you know, that rabbi to become a rabbi at a young age, and therefore when he ultimately wrote his book, so it reflected back on him because he was the one that influenced him. So that's what it means here: "Mi pri pi ish yispatov." From the words that you say, you'll be satiated. From the words that the produce of your mouth is going to bring you satisfaction, because ultimately if you influence someone to do the right thing, that's going to reflect back on you. And then the next part of the pasuk, which is, I think, is similar. It's not as clear to the Mefarshim how it's similar, but I'm going to make a case for it. Ugmul yidei Adam yashiv lo. And the gemul, the kind is probably a word you can use here. The kind activities of your hands, of a person's hands, will be brought back to them, right? Yashiv lo, as it said here. Okay, they translated based on a different parish. It could be that one leads to the other. It's sort of like a kal vachomer that if your words will be, you know, repaid back to you, so obviously your activities will be paid back to you. I see it as two separate clauses, as does the Sefaria, meaning that a person is going to be repaid for the influence he gives to another person. They do good, it's going to reflect back on them. And the person is going to be repaid for the activities they do for another person. I wanted to take it a little more literally, based on a couple of different things. Ugmul yidei Adam yashiv lo. And the act of a person's hands, literally their hands, will come back to them. So this... this is a book I don't think I've ever quoted here. Book I read a few years ago when I was in graduate school. Anyone know this book? It's called The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. Sounds familiar? So this is by a guy named Bruce Perry. He's a little bit of, he's a little full of himself, but he did do a lot of good things, so it's kind of warranted. But he writes this book, and it's a collection of stories. He dealt with some of the most traumatized children when they grew up and were sort of in their adolescence. And the title is literally what happened to a certain child. They were sort of raised in a cage, and they had certain tendencies because of that. And it was his job, when he got them as a teenager, to sort of, bring them out of that mold. And it's kind of crazy stuff. And a lot of the stories have to do with child abuse, and what happened in their homes, and neglect from their parents and things like that, and now trying to get them out of it. The reason I bring it up, I actually don't know if he mentions it in the book or I just know it about him. He famously worked, I think, I don't know if he worked there or they based their practices on his research. Let me just read this. Let me just look this up for a second before I say it. His name is Bruce Perry. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure this is true. There was this phenomenon in Romania with a lot of orphan children. People are familiar with this? The Romanian orphanages. So the question was what to do with these children in terms of bringing them up with a healthy childhood. And he actually I remember this from graduate school. I don't think it's in this book. But it's why I got the book, because I was so fascinated with the study. In order to sort of bring them up give them a childhood that they felt they had sort of love and they had sort of belonging and support, they would actually, the nurses would go over to the children and they would just pet the kids. It sounds strange, but they would pet them. Like for 10 minutes a day, they would just have a hand on their shoulders and rub them and make them feel, through physical touch, make them feel wanted. And he said that that's alone what's going to give them that sense of support and that sense of love, even though they don't know the nurses, but just the feeling of being nurtured is going to give them the sort of the persona of being loved. I'm pretty sure that was him. I don't think I'm getting mixed up at all. But the reason I bring it up is because I recently read a different book. I finished it last week, which I quoted in a drasha two times ago, called "When the Science of Perfect Timing," which was an interesting book, which I read specifically because I just finished Why We Sleep, which is an unbelievable book, which I quoted last week. If you want to scare yourself to try to sleep better, read that book, Why We Sleep. Scary stuff. But then the book When, which was written by, what's his name? Pink, is that his name? Pinker? I have it upstairs also. Written by Daniel S. Pink. Daniel H. Pink. The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. So he brings up an interesting study that they did with basketball players. Now, this is not exactly a study that they did like preemptively, but it was more of like a research, right? So they went to the NBA, right? The NBA is sort of like the professional basketball, right? And they looked at how much teammates touch each other. That sounds like a weird way to say it. How many times would they give each other pats on the back? How many times did they give each other high fives? You know, how many times would they have embraced or something like that? And they say that there's a direct correlation between how much they high five and how much the team wins. Now, this could go in one of two directions. It's not necessarily the case that the touching gives them better skills or anything like that. It's most probably that they're trusting of each other and that elicits more touching, right? That you know, they feel more comfortable with each other that way. So it's not just parallel, I saw this from a sort of a different website, it's not just parallel movements that are important. Physical contact between players on the same team is also associated with a better play. In 2010, psychologists at UC Berkeley discovered that teams that touch more frequently through high fives, chest bumps, and hugs had better records. The reason? More trust and cooperation. So there's something about touching, and why does Pink bring it up is kind of a cheap way to bring it into his book. It almost sounded like he wanted to get more information in his book. It doesn't really, I don't know. I have to sort of read the chapter again. But he plays it up as sort of synchronization, right? That's the timing part of it, right? The book's all about timing, doing things at the right time. So when you're on the same page, when you're doing things together, you're touching each other and doing, I don't know. It was a tough sell for me, but it was fascinating nonetheless, regardless of what book it's in. The reason I bring it up is because between that study from Bruce Perry and this study of the UC Berkeley psychologists, I think you can understand what Shlomo Melech is saying in the second half of this pasuk to be similar to what he said in the first half of the pasuk. The first half of the pasuk was "Mipri pi'ish yispatov," from the words of a person, they'll get satisfied. Right? The way that you speak to another person is going to reflect back on you positively. Similarly, gemul yidei adam, what you give to another person with your hands, yidei adam, the gemul yidei adam, what you do to other people with your hands, yashiv lo, that's also going to be reflected back onto you. The way that you are supportive of another person, the way you embrace another person, the way that you have physical contact with the other person in a supportive and loving way, that too will give over to them a sense of belonging, a sense of support that they'll then take and have a better day, right? It's sort of like giving a smile and giving a hug and giving a high five, giving those physical acts of encouragement will make that person more successful. And that's what I think the pasuk says, not just about how we speak to other people, but how we interact with other people physically, that will also give them that sense of support, that sense of love, that will reflect back on us when they do good things. So it's a little difficult for other mefarshim to understand, but maybe we can understand it that way. Another Rabbi Katz drasha on Shlomo Melech's words. The next pasuk is Tesvav 15:12-15, Derech Eviol Yashar Beinav. This is sort of a repeated theme, but I think it's more indicative of it's sort of a different angle of it. Derech Eviol, the way of the fool is Yashar Beinav. He thinks he's doing the right thing. Right, the fool, when he does something wrong, still thinks he's doing something right. Now, this could be taken in a bunch of different ways. Do they genuinely believe that? Maybe. But odds are, they know what they're doing is wrong. And really, what does it mean, yashar be'inav? It means that they'll pretend like what they're doing is right. Yashar be'inav, it is right in his own eyes. V'shomea le'etzachacham. However, the person who listens to advice, That's the wise person. This is another one of those psukim that we saw, that like we saw last week and the week before that, where the default is that the person did something wrong, right? So derech evil, the fool does something wrong. Yesher beinav, he thinks he did something right. And shomea leitz, so someone who does something wrong but listens to advice, chacham, that person who's going to do better next time, he is the wise person. If you look at the Rabbag, I love how the Rabbag says it, because at least the way the Rabbag says it allows me to say what I'm going to say. So says the Rabbag, derech avil yashar benav ulezeh lo yishal etza. Right? Because the person thinks that what they're doing is good, they're not even going to ask about it. They're not going to ask anybody, hey, did I do good there? Right? Why don't they do that? Says the Rabbag, v'yitbal belu mipnezeh inyanav. Because they know that after they do something wrong, they do something they're not supposed to do, and they'll ask someone about it, that person's going to call them out on it, and then they're going to have to change their ways. They'd rather stay doing the wrong thing and mess everybody else up than admit that they've been doing something wrong. Right? How many times have you had your own, instinct to not say something about it? I remember the first time that I bumped another car. It happens. It was a rainy day outside. I couldn't see my bumper. I couldn't see the other person's bumper. I bumped into somebody backing up in a parking lot. And I was shaken. What do I do? The right thing to do, obviously, leave a note, leave a phone number, whatever. But I could easily just drive away and nobody would ever know about it. So obviously, I left the note, otherwise I wouldn't be telling you the story. I left the note, I left the phone number, and the person called me back, and we had to do the whole insurance thing. And I called the insurance, right? I called the insurance, I tell them what happened, and the insurance company tells me, very few people do that. Very few people, after they hit somebody in a parking lot, will then call the other person or leave a number and then call the insurance to tell them what happened. Because you can easily just leave and not tell anybody, right? You can easily, and never ask the insurance company what to do, never tell the other person what to do. So that's what I think of when the Rabbag says, lo yishal etzav yitzbal blum ibnei zeh inyanav, right? If you would reach out to somebody and tell you what you did, so then you're going to get all mixed up. They're going to tell you to change your ways. They're going to tell you to fix the problem. You don't want to fix the problem. You want to continue the problem and just get out of Dodge. You just want to get it over with. You want to get somebody else, you don't care for somebody else. So in this case, the Rasha, right, the person, the Evil, really it's a fool. It's not really someone who's a Rasha. He doesn't have necessarily bad intentions. They don't want to do something bad. They just are foolish in that they don't want to be better, right? Coming back to the mix, the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset. Evil, derech Evil yashar beinav. Whatever they do is right in their own eyes. The Rabbag says, whatever they do, they don't want to ask anybody, lest it ruin the status quo, lest it cause them to have to fix something or change the way they do something. I'd rather just continue doing the wrong thing all the time. This is something that I remember reading in a book called, what's that book? From, I think it's The Power of Habit, I think it was The Power of Habit, where he talks about, it was Nudge. Do I have the book Nudge? Have I even quoted the book Nudge before?
Rabbi, have you ever heard this one?
Who moved my cheese?
The Rambam writes about habit. I have that book. Great book.
Yeah. Who moved my cheese? I don't know that one.
Yeah. It's Spencer Johnson. He's a doctor.
Okay. I'll look into it.
Look it up.
Okay. I'll look into it. Yeah.
Two people keep doing things the wrong way.
Yeah.
And they don't change the results. So.
Interesting. So this is a book I actually don't have, but I want to get. I think I talked about it. I don't know if I talked about it to a person or in public yet, but it's a book called Nudge, N-U-D-G-E, not to be confused with Nudge, which I didn't really appreciate the nuance or the distinction there until I actually read the book. The first chapter is making that distinction. Nudge is not the same as Nudge. And he goes through the Yiddish origin of the word nudge and that person who's annoying, whatever. A nudge is doing things, changing the context of a person's life so that they make better decisions. And one of the chapters is dedicated, or at least part of the chapter is dedicated to retirement plans, whether they're opt-in or opt-out. What's the default when a person gets a job? A person gets a job, they get a paycheck of whatever it is, $5,000 a month, right? $5,000 a month. So now a person's got $5,000. Now the question is, well, do you want to put that some of that $5,000 into a retirement plan, right? You want to give it up. Let's say now you're only getting $4,000 a month, and $1,000 of it's going to go into a retirement plan. So most people just don't do anything. They just keep it at it, and that's why nowadays younger generations don't have retirement plans. Like, the studies are somewhat shocking. They just don't. They don't plan for retirement. They trust in Social Security, whatever it is. So he makes this whole argument, and he changes, you know, I think they've changed even some laws in some places, that the default should always be opt out, right? That a person, when they get to a job, should automatically have some of his paycheck put into a retirement plan. And you can ask the person, do you want to keep that money or get that money back in your paycheck and not put it in a retirement plan? And fascinating, what happens is almost everybody keeps the money in a retirement plan, right? So everybody that comes in doesn't change to put money in a retirement plan, but anybody who comes in and already gives it to the retirement plan doesn't change it. So what's the deal with that? Everybody just wants to stay in their lane. Everyone just wants to stay exactly what they've been doing. So that's what it talks about in the book Nudge. I really have to quote that book more often. It's a great book. He talks about, what does he talk? He talks about choice architecture. That's what he calls it, a brilliant term. That it's not about making choices for people. It's about setting up the context so that people make better choices. And the first chapter is all about cafeterias. Where do you put healthy foods and where do you put non-healthy foods? It's not making the choice for them. It's not telling them you have to eat this, you have to eat that. But what's at eye level? What's the first thing you see? How big is your plate? How big are the portions, right? That's choice architecture. It's a fascinating concept. We don't always think about it, but we, you know.
How
are stores laid out? What do you see the first thing you walk into the store? I read an interesting one recently. I think by, I don't remember actually. Oh, it was in Why We Sleep that. You know all the candy that's at the register? Yeah. Why is all the candy always at the register? Because after you've been busy for a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour long, making all these decisions, your frontal lobe is so overworked that you have a greater inclination to just feed your desires. So by the time you get to the register, you just, oh, M&Ms. Oh, a Diet Coke. You just pick it up and you buy it because your frontal lobe doesn't have the restraining power anymore to hold you back from those instinctive decisions. So that's also choice architecture. So same thing here. Derech Avil Yashar Beinav, right, says the Ralbag, Lo Yishal Eitzav Yisbal Mibnei Zainyanav. The person doesn't want to ask anybody for advice. He doesn't want to ask anybody else because it's gonna mess up his path. He just wants to keep the status quo. Just keep everything the same way. That's what he means. Then it says that he's always right because he never wants to change anything. Yeah, Michael, you wanted to say something before?
The second reason is your trapped audience checkout line. Whether you're with your kids or not, you're getting a lot of time exposure to that product because you have to wait to check out.
That's interesting too. You're sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. So maybe you can't resist. You can only resist it for so long.
The eye level of the kids. So it's meant for the kids.
Oh, is it for the kids? I don't know. I find a lot of the candies at my eye level, too.
Let me tell you that. It's for adults, too. It's for adults, too. You can opt for some non-candy checkout lines.
Now you can.
Yeah, people underappreciate, first of all, they underappreciate choice architecture, which is what we're just talking about, but people also underappreciate the power of the status quo. It's a real power. It's a force. They talk about it also in Power of Habit or Atomic Habits, one of those two. I always get confused. For understandable reasons. But either way, the power of the status quo. Lo v'yitzba'al b'lu mibnei zeh inyanav. The fool doesn't want to change his path. The fool's path is always right. He doesn't want to change it. They'll keep the status quo as long as they can. That's a fool. The fool doesn't want to change. Again, fixed mindset. V'shomei le'etz ha'chacham. And who is the person that's going to change, that's going to be better? The one who listens to advice. says the Rabbi HaChacham, Afal Pisha Hayarai Lo Lismach Al Da'ato, even though he could rely on his own mind. The Chacham, the wise person, could think to himself. He does have the intellectual capacity, he does have the developed frontal lobe to want to be better. And nonetheless, Hushomei Leitza, he's still going to ask other people, as the Mishnah in Avos tells us, Ezehu Chacham Halomin Mikol Adam. Chacham doesn't mean that you already know stuff, it's that you want to know more stuff. And that's the same thing as the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. It's not that you're stuck on a path and you're not going to change, you don't want to ask anybody, you don't want to learn new things. It's that you're willing to learn new things. You're willing to ask other people. So that's Pasuk Tesvav. Pasuk Tesayin, the last one we'll do tonight. Evil Bayom Yivadakaso. This is so interesting, the way that Shlomo Melech says it. Evil Bayom Yivadakaso. A foolish person, you'll know if they're angry that day. Right? You ever meet someone who's angry? They act in ways that you know they're angry, right? They'll make decisions or they'll make comments and you'll say, okay, that, you know, that guy clearly, like, you know, spilled his coffee, or his kids, you know, didn't get dressed in time, or he was late to a meeting, or, you know, his spouse screamed at him as he left his office, whatever. Like, there's something happened. I can tell that something's wrong with this guy, right? You know, even if they're not necessarily screaming and they're angry or whatever, just the way that they speak to you, you know, hopefully you don't take things personally, and you understand that they're going through something. It's a hard thing to think of sometimes, but they're having some issues. They're going through something on their own, and it shouldn't be a reflection on you. But you could always tell. You could always tell right away. If something happened to them, their anger is going to affect their decisions. Avil bayom yivadakaso. The day that a person is angered, you'll know it right away. You'll know it that day. Bayom. That day. Behayom. Right? When it says bayom, it means that specific day. With a patach underneath it. Always means a specific day. However, v'kose kalon arum. But a clever man, arum is like shrewd. We know that from Bereshis, right? V'kose kalon arum. But a clever man conceals his humiliation. Something bad happens to a person who is who's wise. So what do? They're able to somehow get past it. They're able somehow to reset their mind. Right, to say, okay, I'm angry now, but the next minute's a new minute, right? The next hour is a new hour. The next patient is a new patient. The next interaction is a new interaction. I might have lost that battle, but I'm going to keep going and reset, right? New day. Sometimes that requires a break. Sometimes it requires, you know, maybe meditation. Sometimes it requires taking a walk. You know, whatever it is to reset your mind, reset your body, you'll be able to do that. If you are a room, if you're a shrewd person, says Rashi, "Biyom shehu koes bo bayom hodia kaso shehu mitzgara umecharev chavero." How do you know that the person's angry that day? Because he's going to speak, degradingly to other people, barabim, even in public, right? Ve'ein me'atzer l'rucho, and he's not able to stop his spirit. His spirit is in that mood. He can't stop himself. He doesn't have the restraining power. Aval ha'arum, those who are wise, who are shrewd, kosek kalon ve'eno memaher lariv. They're able to bottle it up. They're able to, you know, cover up their anger, their humiliation, as the pasuk says. Ve'eno memaher lariv. They're not quick to fight with other people. And Rashi says this also could relate to Adam Rishon. This is how the Gemara, at least the Medrash, relates to this pasuk to Adam Rishon. That about how his shame was covered up or wasn't covered up, fine. What's interesting, I think, about the way Shlomo HaMelech says the part of the wise person, the arum, the shrewd person, is that what is it that would create, right? There's always parallel phrasing, right? It's a couplet, right? The first part of the pasuk is one side of the argument, and then the second part is the opposite. So, Avil Bayom Yivadakaso, that day you're going to know is anger. However, when the shrewd one, the Arum, Kosek Kalon, he, on the flip side, the opposite of that, is going to cover his, not his anger, but his humiliation. I find that so interesting. You know, I don't have a source for this, but it would almost imply, the way that Shlomo Melech sets it up, it implies that the fool is angry because he took something personally. Cologne is humiliation. What got him angry? Because he felt he was, he himself criticized, he himself was judged, he himself was made to feel like he was, there's something wrong with him. Right? That's a cologne, right? And oftentimes when we feel personally insulted, when we feel personally offended, that's when we get angry, right? If a person would sort of, you know, dissociate from what's going on, a person criticizes you, you know, so there are two ways to take it. Maybe, as we said before, a fixed mindset person would say, there's something wrong with me. And in order to be defensive, or in my in response of not wanting to accept that, I'm going to then project that anger on somebody else, right? I'm going to be angry because I've been humiliated. As opposed to the Arum, the shrewd person, Kosek Halon, if he's humiliated, if something seems to be a reflection of him, they're willing to say, maybe it's not me, maybe it's something that I could do better. If they're a growth mindset person, they will do better, they'll improve, they'll say, yes, that's right, I can do better, but they won't project it onto somebody else, they won't get defensive about it. It's very interesting how Shlomo Melech uses the word kalon in this context, which creates or doesn't create anger based on how you deal with criticism. That's how I'm interpreting the word kalon, however, at least. So that's sort of like sort of some food to chew on there. When people criticize us, how do we respond? Do we respond with anger towards that person or towards other people, or are we able to sort of take a deep breath, you know, take a break, and then reset our mind, reset our mood, and hopefully not respond in kind or respond to other people who never even deserve it in the first place? Not an easy thing to do. The key in that situation is to first recognize it. First recognize, you know, sometimes that is, this will happen to me where, you know, I'll be working, I'll be doing something, I'll do, I don't know what it is, but I'll feel like I'm in a bad mood, right? You know, and sometimes I don't feel it until someone talks to me, right? As a rabbi, you know, I don't, you know, some people call me, usually in order to talk to people, I have to call them, but oftentimes I'm doing a lot of preparation work, I'm doing a lot of behind the scenes stuff, I'm by myself for a lot of the day. Right? And, you know, I chose the profession because I'm okay with it. I'm an independent worker. But the indicator to me that I'm in a bad mood is when someone says something to me and then I have like an instinct, you know, a more aggressive instinct than I usually do. And, you know, sometimes I catch myself, sometimes I don't, you know, something we can all work on. But the question, you know, oftentimes that will trigger within me, like, what happened? Why am I responding that way? Or why am I not being myself? You know, so, and then I'll sort of rewind, and I'll go back through the hour, the last, you know, 20 minutes, and say, you know, was there an email? Was there a text message? Was there some kind of, you know, thing that I saw that bothered me, that got me in a bad mood? Because our subconscious processes information in ways that we don't even realize, and it puts us in these moods, and we don't necessarily understand it. So if you're an Evil, so then you'll let that subconscious feeling get the best of you, and you'll get angry at somebody else. But if you're an Arum, if you're shrewd about it, you have to be shrewd. You have to understand and really, you know, introspect. What was it that bothered me? How can I dissociate from it? How can I take a break? And how can I reset my mind so that I can be kosek kalon? How can I cover up that humiliation or that kalon, that disgracefulness, whatever it is? Okay, something to think about, and obviously something to work on. So just a little rundown of the themes tonight. We had the fixed mindset versus growth mindset. Always want to become better. You're never who you are, and that's it. You can always become better. You can always improve, and you can always take on projects that seem difficult and learn how to do them better, especially with YouTube. The importance of intimate touch, right? Making nowadays it's harder to do this. You know, I was just wondering to somebody recently, I couldn't remember if I shook people's hands, you know, after the Torah was brought down from the Bima. And, you know, I was like thinking about this last week. I was talking to someone, I don't remember who I was talking to. But you know, I was thinking, you know, the Torah goes down from the steps. I remember that I followed it, but I literally couldn't remember if I shook people's hands when I walked down and followed the Torah. I don't follow the Torah nowadays, so it hasn't been, you know, it's been 10 months since I've done that. But I literally couldn't remember. But when we get back to that moment, when we get to back to that time, where I would think I would. I just don't remember.
Yeah, I think you did too.
So the importance of physical contact, obviously in a healthy way, in a safe way, the physical contact really makes a difference in people's lives. And then we saw the fool doesn't want to change his path, the status quo, the opt-in versus opt-out, the retirement plan, and then lastly, understanding, being cunning in our own mind, you know, that shrewd intelligence to understand when we've been bothered and how that's reflecting towards other people. Okay, everyone should have a good night. Thank you very much. Stay warm. Shoshana, enjoy the rest of the trip, and Mazel Tov, it should all go well and go smoothly. And safely.
Thank you.
And by the way, for those who are wondering, last week, the word of